on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our conversation with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer. He has related his experiences aboard the cruiser USS Houston in World War II, not the one sunk in the Battle of Sunda Strait in 1942, but the Houston crippled by torpedo bomber attacks in 1944 near Formosa, what we know now as Taiwan. The Houston would be torpedoed again days later after most of the crew had evacuated. By the way, I've added more photos of the Houston and the damage it sustained to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you want to take a look there, you'll see what Jonas Hofer looked like as a young Navy man, too. Mr. Hofer was on the ship for both torpedo attacks, but in between those two, those of you remaining on the ship had to do something to honor those killed in that initial attack.
Well, we had a burial of about 40 guys in that time. And what we would do is then, you would, if the guy was dead, you'd check him out and you'd put an M on their forehead. And then you'd take a 5-inch shell and put it between their legs and wrap canvas around twice and sew it up. And then you'd put them on a board like this here against the ship's railing. And then I'd play taps, and they'd dump it like that, and the canvas would go out from underneath the top covering that there.
And they would slide into the water.
You couldn't haul them all in, you know, because you didn't know when you're going to come into shore and that. And they would, our power was all out. We had no air refrigeration or that anymore. And there were about, I suppose, from 40 to 60 guys that were still in the water down there, and you couldn't get them out. This was all topside guys, and we buried 10 at a time. So we did 4 times, so I say there's 40 that were buried.
And you just answered my next question. I was putting 2 and 2 together, saying if you're the head of the bugle crew on this ship, that you might have had to play taps. What was that like for a burial at sea, to be the guy where everyone's attention is on you, and you know what a somber situation this is?
I always said you didn't have to worry about vibrato. It came automatically. You had to really concentrate, you know, not to think that these are your friends that you're burying now and that you wanted to play the taps right. You had to really think about that there. And afterwards, the officers all came up and thanked you and figured, how did you keep your cool on that there? Well, I had a hard time.
Did you lose any close friends on that ship?
Oh, yes, yeah. Although, from our division, the navigation, of course, we were all in the bridge. We only lost one guy, and we lost him in the States. I won't say his name. But when we got ashore and that there, some of the guys had quite a bit of money on them, maybe from $600 to $1,000 that they had saved up or got gambling and that there. So, of course, they hit the beach, you know. And one of these guys, as far as we could tell, in the morning they found him dead in the alley. He had been stabbed to death. But they remembered him and a girl leaving that bar and that and going, they think they went to a hotel room. Nobody knew the girl or that there and that, so we never did find out exactly, but the papers had in there that she probably killed him for the $1,200 worth of money.
So after surviving all of this, surviving the time in the water, getting rescued, finally getting something to eat again, getting your wits about you again, they brought you back to the States and said, hey, we've got another ship for you to go on. Were you excited to get on another ship, or had you had enough at that point?
Before that, we went to Hawaii, and Hawaii gave us a month's survivor's leave at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel.
Tough assignment.
Yes, and they gave us surfboards to use, golfing clubs and all that for a month. I didn't know I was in the Navy then. The day after that month was over, we were in the Navy again, heading for the States. Then we got to Treasure Island, and for 3 weeks we were on there, and they were getting our written reports. And then I got another month's survivor's leave at home. Got to go fishing with some cousins and that. And then I went back. I was assigned to the Kula Gulf and had to go up to Bremerton, Washington, where I caught this ship here.
Well, and you mentioned another month of survivor's leave at home. Did you tell your mother everything you'd been through? How did that go when you saw her again? And
no, well, just that we had been swimming. No, you didn't. You didn't tell your mother very much at all, because she wouldn't want you to go again, that's for sure. But she knew it was rough. We had a plan. My folks, my mother knew always where I was at. I had bought two maps when I was home, and I put numbers by 40 of those different spots throughout the world. Casablanca, a few over there, but most of them South Pacific, because I figured we'd be there. And so when I wrote her a letter, and maybe I'd write in there, oh, I saw the funniest thing. There was a guy that was 38 pounds, and that meant 38 what? Walking down the street, and he was a little pygmy, and he weighed only 38 pounds. But he was walking like a grown man. Well, she took that 38, went to the map. Oh, that's this island here. That's Guam. And so they knew where I was at by my letters and that. Of course, sometimes it took your letters 2 or 3 weeks to get home.
But you found a way to beat those censors who would have cut that information out if you had spelled it out.
In your letters, you know, there'd be big black spots that they would just mark through, because all your mail was censored by the officers, yeah.
Maybe you know the answer to this, or maybe you don't, but when your ship was under attack and torpedoed and all that, in that aftermath, was your mother ever in a situation where she didn't know if you were alive or not?
Here's something else. Our ship was sunk October the 19th. My mother couldn't sleep that night at home. Now, this is unusual. So she thought, well, I'm in the most dangerous place there is. I'm the only one in the service. So she got up and prayed for me that night. My brother was going to Biola then in Los Angeles. He couldn't sleep either. But my mother circled it on the 19th on the calendar. So when I came home later and started talking to him and that there, and my brother did the same thing. He couldn't figure out why did he think about me so much? And must be for prayer and that. So they marked that 19th of October. When I came home, my mother told me about that. She says, what happened on the 19th? I says, 19th is when we got our second torpedo. We had to get in the water and that there. And, well, were you ever afraid you won't go? No, I was too young to think about that. And so she couldn't understand that at all. But when we checked it, both of them had the same dates on the phone.
When October 19th rolls around on the calendar every year, I think about it a lot because that's my birthday. But I wonder if you... It's my birthday, but I wonder if every October 19th, do you take a moment and reflect on that date's significance in your life?
I usually remember it, yeah, is, today's October the 19th. Yeah, I think about it, yeah, and I'm thankful to the Lord. I mean, when you think of only 8 of us picked up that time, getting in out of all those guys and that there, something was really going on.
When you tell people that story, and maybe... I'm sure there are parts of those that you don't tell all the time. Have you ever had anybody say, that's too hard to believe?
Never have. Really, that's a sounding thing. No, I did have once when, for something else, we had our store and I had a friend who came to the store in Dinuba, and I was cleaning this. I swept the sidewalk off in front of our store all the time in the morning before everybody else came. And a friend I hadn't seen for 30 years came from Sacramento, come walking up and says, Jonas, so what are you doing here? And I says, I'm cleaning the side. Well, he says, my mother's living in town here, and I hadn't seen him since high school. And he says, well, I came to visit my mother and that here, and would you want to go out today for lunch and that? I says, yeah, come down here and we'll go. So we went for lunch. I felt like, you know, I never told Lee my testimony. In high school, I hadn't. So I said, Lee, should I tell you my life story? And I told him all about this ship and saving that, having a family, 6 kids now, and some grandchildren, how good the Lord has beaten me. And well, he says, you know what I think about that? It's a bunch of BS. It didn't bother me because I told him, I says, this is my life story and I'm just telling you what it is. And that 3 weeks later, he was there again. When I was at, he rode the bus here from the Greyhound bus in the morning, got there about 9 o'clock when we opened up the store. Want to have coffee? And I says, yeah, okay. And as soon as the others come, we went out and had coffee. Well, he says, since I last talked to you that time, I couldn't get that out of my mind. Because look at how I've wasted my life. I was 12 years in prison. He says, I thought of how rotten my life was in that. So, yeah, this was Monday. Yesterday, I went out above Sacramento in the woods over there, and I tied a rope around my neck. I was going to kill myself. But he says, I got in a tree, and I tied the rope up, and then before I could jump, I heard, but God. I looked around to see if there's anybody else, nobody else there, and I thought, what in the world? I got ready to jump again, and this time louder than before, the same thing. I took the rope off and got down, got on the bus, and I'm here now. What do you think that is? And I says, Lee, it's God giving you another chance. That's all it is giving you another chance. And he says, well, I'm not quite ready for that. But he says, I have had about 12 years in prison, two different times. So my life has just been shot. Never got married or anything like that. I says, well, Lee, I'm still saying, you got one chance. God's giving you another chance. About 5 days later, he came and says, well, you know what happened? Sunday night, and he could play every instrument. In the prison, he learned how to play all the strings instruments, and he was good. He'd come in the store and sit in a chair and play whatever person wanted. And he said, I was at this meeting the other night at the Full Gospel Church, and the pastor looked down, and he looked at me, and he said, there's somebody down there that you got the last chance. God has given you the last chance. He says, I looked around at that, and he's pointing right at me, he said. So afterwards, I was so convicted after the service, I went up there, and I accepted the Lord. So we had dinner together, and from then he stayed in Dinuba for the next year, and I tried to counsel him and help him along in that day. But he was a changed guy.
Well, and it sounds like the power of your story and your convictions had a role in helping him make that change. Good for you. And speaking of change, let me change gears here and get you to the second ship you served on during World War II. We've talked so much about the Houston and how you survived, and then you had your recuperation in Hawaii and back in the States, and then they assigned you to the escort carrier USS Kula Gulf.
I was on a Kula Gulf for 44, 45, and then in 46, the Kula Gulf was a very, very lucky ship. We were strafed, but the bombs always missed. One time the bombs was in 20 feet of the ship, put up and went off and hit the water, put so much water on it, washed two guys off the flight deck, and the flight deck is 60 feet above, so that tells you what kind of wave that put over. And we never did find them. But they always missed the ship. All the kamikazes and that there.
And this is a big target. I mean, this is a carrier.
2 football fields long. And the Franklin, which is 1,000 feet long, 900 and bigger even than that, was beside them when it was hit by a bomb. And although they did get the fire out, but they lost 300 people in the fire and that there. So we were afraid. I've seen other ships sunk right around us that the battle wagon that shot them and eight holes in them, you know, a whole salvo.
Is this at Okinawa?
Now, this was above the Philippines when we took the Philippines back. I always thought a lot of people think that we did a bad thing by using the atomic bomb. But I said if we hadn't used the atomic bomb, we could have lost another million people. Because Japan was gearing up for over there. They were teaching their, I know this from my friends, 13-year-old boys to be on the beach and give themselves for that. And the kamikazes, too, were really getting going then. Where the guys would give their life, thought nothing about it and that then. But we were very fortunate in the Kula Gulf. And then I was on it when we took it after the war. They made it out into a troop ship. And they put all the hangar deck, took the airplanes out. We went into China. We brought 5,000 new Marines to China and picked up 5,000 Marines and brought them to the States. We made 3 trips into the Yangtze River. So I got to see China for about those trips. For the last 6 months, I was there after the war. And just a mass of people, China.
Was there a lot of celebration when you guys found out Japan had surrendered?
Thought it was really wonderful that they put MacArthur in charge, because he was a level-headed guy, regardless of what Truman thought about him. And so MacArthur, you know, asked the United States, he says, now's your chance to send 1,000 missionaries over here. Our MB church started out with missionaries over there. We have 27 churches in Japan today that all started after that, yeah. And the people admired him because he was very fair.
Was it difficult for you to adjust to life as a civilian once you got out of the Navy?
No, that's the difference between World War II guys and after that, Vietnam and some of them, where they were kind of reviled. And in fact, I had a cousin that when he got off in San Francisco from Vietnam, they spit at him. With us, they kind of figured we're heroes and that. We got home and forgot about all of it and went back to school and work and that there. Figured, well, we did our part. I've never felt like a hero. We did what we had to do. And after we got back, we decided, well, my friends are getting all married and that there, so I better find a girl too. And I went back to Tabor College then. My girlfriend was going back there too, so both of us did. Then the next year came back and got married in 48.
Yeah, you were just 24 years old then, and you had had more close calls, more heartache, and even more adventures in those 24 years, I guess, than most of us do. But you had a pretty significant adventure just in the last couple months here, and I want to discuss that when we come back. We'll wrap up our two-part interview with Jonas Hofer by hearing about his experience with Honor Flight. Hometown Heroes will come down the home stretch right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.